being alive to the fact that law is a starting question, not a final answer, is key in terms of how we think about our engagement with communities, our approaches to permitting, our approaches to environmental compliance.
My name is Sarah Carnegie, and I'm the Legal Projects Director at the International Bar Association. Together with my team, the Legal Policy and Research Unit, we've created a series of podcasts on business and sustainability to look at the rapidly increasing need for companies to act responsibly and sustainably, considering not only legal obligations, but also those set out in soft law, such as the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, which are now hardening at pace. In this episode, IBA business and human rights lawyer Maria Pia Sacco and I spoke with Jonathan Hock, who is head of legal and commercial for global mining company Anglo American, where he's worked for the last 23 years. Anglo American is a company with a portfolio of mining and processing operations in 15 different countries with 56 sites. Anglo American has made many business and human rights and sustainability commitments in their business plan, and our conversation will look at their approach to human rights, taking into account the particular needs of the communities where they work. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today. I'd like to start with the journey that Anglo American has been on in respect of taking more action in business and human rights. And I understand it started with a gap analysis and various awareness raising activities with leadership behind it. So it'd be great if you could tell us a bit more about what you did to raise awareness and to bring about change both internally and externally with your stakeholders.
Thank you. Sometimes difficult to pinpoint with accuracy when a journey starts, but certainly Anglo American has been a long-standing signatory and an active member of the UN Global Compact since 2004, including many of its local networks. And I'd like to think the journey even started before then. It was not until we launched our Sustainable Mining Plan in 2018 as part of the Future Start Mining Program that we consciously took what I think were the first steps to establish ourselves as a leader in sustainable mining. We recognize that our industry has to address critical challenges of safety, productivity, and the way we use land, energy, and water, and the importance of ensuring we establish and maintain our social license to operate. A sustainable mining plan, which forms part of a holistic approach to sustainability in our business, was developed through extensive internal and external engagement, and is built around three major areas or global sustainability pillars aligned to the UN Sustainable Development Goals. These are healthy environment, thriving communities, and trusted corporate leader. Our sustainable mining plan sets out a series of deliberately ambitious global stretch goals relating to each of these, and which we aim to achieve by 2030, alongside next milestones, which we hope to achieve in 2025.
So, Jonathan, do you think that there are aspects of what you do that you'd regard as best practice for the wider mining industry? And do you share those with others in order to try and create some consistency over perhaps what may be seen as an optimal way of operating?
Certainly, we engage with different mining companies globally and have been working with teams in Australia, South Africa and the UK around modern slavery and how we support human rights. They're obviously complex issues, and ensuring you've got your arms around the size of the problem is always a bit more complicated. But we are hoping that by working with our peer groups and outside of our peer groups, we can actually find ways to share information, obviously in a way that is compliant with competition law, but that actually supports best industry practices and enables us to potentially develop new strategies to ensure that we are managing these problems correctly. Another area that is clearly evolving is around digitization and data analytics and our ability to use AI as part of our value chain assessments.
Thank you, Jonathan. In the last decade, many countries have introduced or considered introducing laws on human rights due diligence or transparency for companies. As far as the mining sector is concerned, we have seen important developments in the US with Section 502 of the Dodd-Frank Act, and more recently with the introduction of the Conflict Minerals Regulation in the EU. What has the impact of these standards been on the way in which Anglo American tackles human rights risks in its global operations? And how do you, as head of legal in a global mining company, navigate this fragmented legal framework?
The legal environment and the role of lawyers is continuing to evolve. Currently, we don't fall within the net of Dodd-Frank or a number of the European legislative developments. But we are obviously mindful of these, and certainly it would not be a stretch of the imagination to assume similar regimes will not apply in the UK in the not-too-distant future. And that means we are already well on the way to embedding the disciplines and processes to ensure we are compliant with not only law, but with society's expectations. A sustainable mining plan has provided a platform to anchor and reinforce our commitment to human rights, which had obviously been previously demonstrated through our being a signatory to the Global Compact and the voluntary principles of security and human rights. One recent example of this was in relation to gender-based violence in communities around our operations in South Africa, where we have worked with the National Shelter Movement of South Africa in assisting women suffering from domestic violence, which has been exacerbated in the context of COVID-19 and lockdowns. We have supplied funding, support, donations of accommodation, and enabled resources to provide refuge and food to members of the most affected communities, as well as supporting the provision of training to assist clinical health workers in identifying and investigating potential gender-based violence cases. If we want to be seen to be making a difference, if we want to be living to our purpose, which is reimagining mining to improve people's lives, we need to demonstrate that mining has positive benefits, brings opportunities. To shift that narrative, that perception that mining is only destructive and exploitative, and there's definitely a journey here in terms of how we are trying to reshape people's perspectives. To be honest, if we don't do that, we won't be relevant in a couple of years. So we have to be seen to be making a positive influence in the communities where we operate.
Thank you, Jonathan. That's really interesting. I was wondering whether and how you managed to involve your suppliers in this journey, for instance, when it comes to company-based grievance mechanisms and due diligence activities.
It's part of our shift has been to how we have established our responsible sourcing standard, and through that, adopting more robust onboarding processes, as well as undertaking due diligence and obtaining commitments from our suppliers that they will adhere to our standards, making it clear what our expectations are.
Are lawyers working in private practice following this approach, and have you seen a change there?
Absolutely. I think the reality is the world has changed, and the legal profession needs to keep up with that. We need lawyers who are willing to sort of be more aware of the issues, that aren't just providing pure legal advice. You need that broader perspective, the understanding of the interplay between hard and soft law and how that then shapes the advice that's required for a particular situation.
Jonathan, you have mentioned Anglo-American's Future Smart Mining, which is based on the three pillars of technology, digitalization, and sustainability. Can you tell us more about it, and how can new technologies help us in promoting sustainability?
There are sort of four key areas that I'll touch on briefly. One of them is concentrating the mine, which is really focused on how we can get more product out of our operations more efficiently with least impact in terms of water and energy. I certainly won't try and talk through all of the technical explanations of that, but one visible demonstration of that is our commitment to the hydrogen truck. This is a project which is, I think, probably atypical for a mining company to necessarily be championing, to be leading. The second key area is capturing the vast amounts of data we are generating in our operations and finding other ways to incorporate sensors into our business that enables us to actually understand and therefore more efficiently mine our areas. Finally, there's the modern mine construct, which really is around ensuring we get people home safely, and that is trying to find ways to automate as much as we can. But we recognize there's a challenge there in terms of balancing and retraining a workforce so that they are not displaced by our approach to mining.
Anglo American has obviously a very diverse portfolio of products, and we've already touched on the luxury goods, the De Beers, diamonds, but also copper, platinum, group metals, and they're building blocks, as we know, of everyday products that we all need and use. So in that sense, whether you've got views on what the role of the consumers should be or is in integrating sustainability in your business model?
Certainly the experience across our various commodities is different. Some are closer to customers. If we think about platinum suppliers and to vehicles, the automotive industry is going to be quite sort of focused on sustainability outcomes. Whereas in the steel sector, we're probably further removed from the end consumer, and therefore we certainly are seeing less, or have seen less pressure there. But I think conceptually we are obviously positioning ourselves that we can demonstrate our sustainability competitive advantage, and why we should hopefully be one of the preferred suppliers.
Having seen the film Blood Diamond and having had the general public awareness on how diamonds were being sourced, it's interesting that
that it required something like that almost to shine a spotlight on the provenance of that particular material. And has that then led to things being put in place which inevitably mean the product is more expensive, and yet the consumer is willing to absorb that additional cost because of the reassurance about the product now being clean, if you like? Is that something, is that a mindset that applies across all commodities now? Because if the cost of what you're having to do needs to increase, that is essentially absorbed satisfactorily by a customer, by somebody that you're supplying on the basis that there's the reassurance in place. Because obviously you're operating against competitors, some of whom won't be using the same methods as you and maybe undercutting processes by the way that they're doing their particular processing.
What we found is that actually often some of the steps we're putting in place in terms of mining more sustainably, in fact, reduce costs. And so I think there is definitely some of the benefit that flows from that can be passed on to customers. We certainly are seeing a sort of a change in terms of the expectations of in-house counsel and the kind of problems we need to deal with. And with that, there are certainly opportunities. So, for example, in our treasury environment, we are looking at ways in which we can use, again, our sustainability plan to approach our banks, our funders, and sort of identify ways whether there are sort of pro-competitive opportunities for us to leverage lower finance. So, again, it's kind of looking out for those opportunities, but it's recognizing the risks as well. And so, obviously, there are trends in terms of the issues we need to watch, be alert, extra alert for an M&A. There are the litigation trends we need to be alive to and see how those are evolving. Being alive to the fact that law is a starting question, not a final answer, is key in terms of how we think about our engagement with communities, our approaches to permitting, our approaches to environmental compliance.
We then sought the views of current IBA president, Sternford Moyo, one of the leading corporate and commercial lawyers in Southern Africa, chair of the law firm Scallon and Holderness in Zimbabwe. Sternford is an expert in mining and business and human rights, so his perspective on these issues is particularly interesting. We're delighted to be speaking with you today, Sternford, and obviously today's discussion is centred on the mining industry. We've been speaking with Anglo-American and Jonathan Hawk, as you'll be aware. But I wanted to ask you, if I may, about laws around human rights due diligence and transparency for companies. And we've seen that many countries, both in and out of Europe, have introduced or considered introducing laws in this regard. And as far as the mining sector is concerned, we've seen important developments in the United States with Section 1502 of the Dodd-Frank Act back in 2010, and more recently, the introduction of the Conflict Minerals Regulation, which came into force in January 2021. So these provisions, as we know, are complemented by soft law standards and industry initiatives. But what's your view on the impact of these standards on rights holders and local communities?
Thank you for that question, Sarah. The new standards are in reality a consolidation of commitments made by business during the Rio conference, the Johannesburg Earth Conference, the Earth Summit by the United Nations. The commitments have given rise to a dramatic development of a new business philosophy in terms of which businesses are committing to making a positive difference to the communities in which they do business. Most successful businesses today do make it part of their policy to make a positive difference to the communities in which they operate. Furthermore, I think the new development will result in dramatic regulatory growth. In addition, one can see a growth in remedies available to victims of human rights violations in this space. Ultimately, of course, the desired effect of all this will be an enhanced protection of human dignity.
Thank you. And what do you think the role of the global legal profession would be in guiding companies through this legal framework?
Yes, the legal profession has an important role to play. Firstly, the profession will play a role in identifying internationally recognized human rights, which are to be respected by the corporates. By identifying the rights, they will assist in identifying the commercial, financial, and reputational risks associated with any violations. Furthermore, lawyers will assist in developing operational level grievance handling mechanisms. They will also assist in the interpretation, indeed preparation, and promotion of the regulations which will be put in place in order to protect human rights.
Thank you, Stanford. Gold mining is Zimbabwe's largest foreign currency earner, closely followed by tobacco. However, the relationship between the extraction of natural resources and the development of local communities is still weak. You took part in the IBA Task Force on Illicit Financial Flows, Poverty and Human Rights. I was wondering whether you can tell us more about the link between poverty, human rights, and natural resources.
Poverty is the biggest obstacle to realization of human rights. It has a negative impact on the quality of life. The right to life, of course, is one of the human rights that ought to be recognized and protected. Access to healthcare is affected by poverty. Access to justice is affected by poverty. The right to shelter and other socioeconomic rights are all adversely affected by poverty. Companies, those operating in extractive industries, have to develop policies which ensure that they respect human rights and provide remedies where human rights are violated.
From your perspective, what can companies do to make sure that natural resources are more equally shared with local communities?
The first step is the development of policies which ensure respect for developmental rights of the communities where businesses operate. They also need to embrace stakeholder engagement to ensure that depletion of resources is made by development of the communities where those resources are found.
Do you have any particularly good examples of that, Stanford? Have you seen where that's working well in your experience?
Well, in fact, it is now quite widespread. In many parts of the world, you do find corporate social responsibility working quite well. In some communities, you find that in addition to corporate social responsibility, there is a requirement to report on what is being done in the annual reports of companies. You also find communities where indigenous people have been given equity in the companies that operate in their communities. There have also been share schemes to benefit employees of the companies that operate in these communities.
I think that takes me on to thinking about high-risk areas where we know there are conflicts and all sorts of difficulties which are under consideration, and how companies operate in those areas without exacerbating the conflicts must be very, very challenging. Do you have any thoughts on that?
First step is for a company to embrace human rights due diligence, to assess the levels of risk involved before operating in any particular environment. Because if a company just moves in without identifying the risks, there is a danger that it may incur some commercial, financial, and reputational risks. There is also a danger that a company may end up being complicit in human rights violations by the host regimes in those communities. Once companies have identified the risks, they have got to put in place programs that ensure that those risks are minimized. They also have to put in place programs and policies to ensure that in cases where violation is taken place, there are remedies provided. They also need to work hand in hand with communities in order to try to understand the expectations of those communities. They should try to engage civic society in those communities so that they are aware of the work that has already been done by civic society and the dangers that they may fall into if they just operate without taking into account the environment in which they are operating.
In terms of the business and human rights, the UN guiding principles on business and human rights, we know they've been now 10 years in existence, and that the IBA has played a very important role in promoting the active role of the legal profession to advance business and human rights and sustainability. So now, with a forward-looking lens, what do you see as the challenges and opportunities for the profession and in the IBA for over the next decade?
The main challenge for the legal profession, as I see it, is some kind of transformation in line with the new demands. It will be necessary for lawyers to transform their thinking. Business law and human rights do not mix well. That will have to be abandoned to embrace the new thinking that it is not really possible to practice business law effectively without an appreciation or an acceptance or an understanding of human rights. Lawyers will have to be proactive when dealing with these matters. They will have to be proactive in order to anticipate the risks that their clients are likely to incur when operating in some of these environments, in environments which are high risk indeed. So there should be a new shift in the thinking of lawyers, and that is a challenge to play a meaningful role to embark on continuing legal education so that they start learning more and more about ESG issues. They start learning more and more about this field, which has some fluid issues that are changing on a regular basis. So there is a role for lawyers to improve their own understanding of the law around human rights, the law around protection of communities where their clients operate. Corporate social responsibility is now part of the philosophy of any serious company operating in any place today. Many companies, in fact, especially international companies, today appreciate that in some jurisdictions where they operate, they have got greater resources than the governments in those countries. And because of that, they've got a special responsibility to look after the communities where they operate. So it is really now part and parcel of the new thinking, part and parcel of business philosophy.
Well, that's very powerful and extremely important. So thank you for that.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you on this subject.
Finally, we spoke with legal practitioners from Colombia and France. Maria Angelica Burgos works for Baker McKenzie at their Bogota office, specialising in international arbitration. Stéphane Brabant is a practitioner with over 30 years' experience in the mining and energy sectors, notably in Africa, but has a global reputation as an ESG expert. So, Maria Angelica, what is your thoughts about the role of the global legal profession in guiding companies through this fragmented legal framework and how you engage with general counsel and in-house legal teams on these issues?
This is a critical role. I think the legal profession has been thinking about it over the past years, even after the UNGPs were adopted. There has been wide discussion as to now, us as lawyers, how do we help our clients, how the profession helps others understand this changing and very important obligations and legal framework that is arising. We have been growing and learning from this process. It's interesting for me to see in the past few months, in the past years, how more and more private practitioners are engaging in topics pertaining to even in a wider aspect of environmental, social, governments, ESG matters, as well as specifically in human rights matter. I think this is something we had not seen, I'd say, probably 10 years ago. And that shows precisely that there's an interest and that there's a desire of the legal profession to actually be of support to the users and to our clients in how to understand this legal framework. In my view, I think the IBA Practical Guide for Business and Human Rights for Lawyers, it's a critical resource. It's very wide. It covers basically all of the aspects of private practitioners that private practitioners touch upon, and it provides very useful insight as to how to approach matters which would probably, as I said, are new or are novel in our profession. And I think that the key takeaway for me from the practical guide is that in everything that we do as lawyers, in our special areas of expertise, there's always room to think about human rights and how our clients and the advice that we're providing to our clients will have or could have impacts or effects on human rights and on the way they themselves engage in human rights. And that's, I think, key takeaway one. And the second one is we as companies have also human rights impact within ourselves. And I also think that's very interesting because, again, we see firms and we see private practitioners thinking about how they themselves can also cause impact and how they themselves can also manage and understand those impacts. I think that's a very interesting turnaround we've seen over the past years. And I expect that in the coming future, it will continue to grow. It will continue to enhance a conversation. You asked also about how do you engage with GCs and in-house counsel on these issues? And in a similar way, what I have experienced is that they've also had a growing interest on these topics and on the discussion growing around this topic. So I just remember a few years ago, there was a very interesting discussion we had in Colombia, my jurisdiction, where we had the participation of several companies and they were interested in understanding what was going on in other countries, how they could tackle their challenges and how they could implement and know about best practices. So I think this is a topic also that's, and the reason why this conversation is ongoing is precisely because there's interest on both sides of the spectrum of the conversation. And I expect that to continue to grow as we continue to learn and as regulations continue to emerge.
So Stefan, I'd be really interested to get your take on what the role of the global legal profession is in guiding companies through the fragmented legal framework and how you engage with in-house counsel on these issues.
Yes, indeed. I think you get it right by saying that it is fragmented. It's fragmented first because there is some soft law and some hard law, as you very rightly said, and also because in various jurisdictions or at international level, things can be drafted or said a little bit differently. But there are some common bases. First, we speak of universal rights. Second, we speak of universal tool to some extent to avoid or prevent or mitigate those violations of human rights through the UN guiding principles. And third, we can say that there's some sort of a universal legal guide for business lawyers produced by the IBI. Also, to some extent, we can say that there's a potential universal legal framework with a potential directive of EU and the treaty, the EU with extraterritoriality. And we shall speak later on, there is a response to fragmentations to some sort of universal technology, which is the blockchain. So what is the role of lawyers is to make things working for victims, because that's the very purpose of the business in human rights. And for this, we can say, and we can see that there is less and less differences between all those soft law, hard law, and various legislations. It is very much an opportunity with business in human rights to be what I would call a revolution of the law, to make it very international. This is a wonderful opportunity. Indeed, soft law becomes hard very, very rapidly. And therefore, when it becomes harder and harder, then it can be unified through the various jurisdictions and between soft law and hard law. Therefore, the fragmentation could disappear to some extent, at least. Also with international arbitration, which could unify.
Thank you, Stefan. And with a focus again, perhaps on Europe, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what the impact of a future EU-wide legislation will be on mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence for the mining industry.
Well, concerning the EU, I would recommend those people to listen, to read the excellent recommendations which have been drafted by the Parliament for the directive. They are extremely well done and explained. There are four things I would say. First, importance of minerals, number of goods. This is something that we don't realize, but minerals is everywhere. And therefore, awareness of companies have to be everywhere. Second, how does it go with the EU drafting? First, there's an importance of the size of companies. In fact, it can be large companies or it can be small and medium-sized companies under certain conditions, and even some companies which would, I quote, when they operate in the EU internal market, selling goods or providing services. So there is some sort of extraterritoriality, a bit like in corruption in some instances. Therefore, the more companies are concerned, the more awareness will go over. So thanks to the EU regulations, there'll be more and more awareness. Also, the importance of the scope. It concerns human rights, environment, and governance. Also, the importance of sanctions. In fact, indeed, with the sanctions, civil, criminal, administrative, they will encourage compliance and better protection of victims and the planet. Also, we can stress the importance of the reversal of burden of proof, which will make some differences. Lastly, the importance of the new legal playing field and security, which is requested by many companies. Therefore, the importance of due diligence, which will make the difference at the EU level. And the EU regulation, with your question, we could say, could become a reference, if not the reference, with the UN guiding principles, it goes without saying, for a treaty at some stage.
Thank you, Stefan. You have spoken about the importance of protecting victims. I'm just wondering whether you can tell us more about how companies can operate in high-risk areas without exacerbating the situation and negatively affecting the most vulnerable in society.
It is, in fact, all to do with the mapping of risk. And whatever you're in conflict zone or in high-risk areas or in some other circumstances, all is to do is the mapping of the risk. And this is where companies, wherever they face, it is project by project, geography by geography, situation by situation, a mapping of the risk. And indeed, I would say that it is high-risk areas is one of them. And for this, there is more attention because indeed, it can be very delicate on the everyday practice for mining companies. It cannot be a tick the box. It has to be project by project. It's a bit like obtaining the social license. And in fact, with the social license, it goes one by one. It is to identify the risk and to make it that the population at the end would be happy. If they're happy, there'll be less conflict. There'll be less problems. And in fact, business and human rights is one of the key for obtaining the social license. So all these have some coherence and goes together. In fact, risk can be very different. And in those areas of high risk areas, you can encounter some risks which are different from some other areas, like very, very tough child labor, forced labor, extortion of funds, illegal tax, illegal intermediaries, security forces. Of course, there are some reference. Many vulnerable persons, bribery, fraudulent misrepresentation, and so on and so forth. Therefore, there are some specificities of risk in those areas, and this needs certainly some experts and on ground. The very objective, in any case, is to avoid any problems to escalate and therefore to avoid any more conflicts.
Just as an additional thought on what you've said, whether you've had to consider operating in countries where the government doesn't have actual control on the ground, really, and so you're operating against armed militia. So I'm thinking particularly of Democratic Republic of the Congo and Central African Republic, where we've spoken with the UN Global Compact on their work with forced labour of children, the worst forms of child labour. Are those areas that you've had to advise on, and is there any remote way in which companies can sensibly operate under those conditions?
Yes, indeed, I did. I mean, those areas can be more challengeable than some other. That's very true. And this is where companies have to take into account those due diligence in a very pragmatic and intelligent manner with a good knowledge of on-ground what is going on. And I think it is the attitude of the companies to be realistic in facing the situations which would make a huge difference. And this is where the mechanism of due diligence are absolutely key and have to be taken seriously, step by step, one by one, with some expert, with some people who knows what it is about, how to do the mapping. The mapping can be geographic, cultural, with some political problems, army problems, rebels, and so on and so forth. And I faced those situations where I took so much time in analyzing the situation one by one, step by step, element by element, and to try to think about each of them and to try to say, okay, is my way to go going to jeopardize even more the situation? Or am I going through my business, am I going to bring to the population and to the country and to the environment more respect of human rights and therefore less conflicts and therefore a more sustainable region project for the best for the population?
Thank you, Stefan. You have spoken about the importance of having a social license for companies to operate. However, we have recently heard about stories of CEOs and senior executives failing to meet this standard and being forced to resign. Can lawyers advise companies to avoid similar incidents?
It is an interesting story. It's not unique. I mean, it happened to that CEO, but it could have happened to many others. In fact, there could be within some companies, they might sometimes underestimate the role of what we call the social license compared to the legal license. And it is new, by the way. It is a new mindset for companies and for lawyers. And this is very new. And the fact for lawyers, as for businessmen and for CEO to know, I've got to think not only about my legal license, but also to a social license is really new. And I can tell you that it is still not very easy to get all people be aware of this. So it proves that indeed there is a role for lawyers again, all around the CEOs and CFOs and others, especially for lawyers, to bring attention to companies and their authorities, CEOs and CFOs, and that's a duty, that indeed they should, in fact, advise them on the importance of social license, and it means more specifically the respect of human rights within the social license. So you can realize that the teaching, the training by lawyers is something which is absolutely key. Otherwise, we would have companies, their CEOs and CFOs, and this is an example, to suffer a very hard, what I call soft law but hard sanctions.
Stefan, you referred previously to the OECD recent guidance published on how to address bribery and corruption risk in mineral supply chains. And we're looking at this actually in relation to the broader modern slavery work that we're doing in the IBA. But I'm interested to know your thoughts on what is the link between human rights violations and corruption and how companies can address these challenges holistically.
Well, I would say that corruption is a violation of human rights as it stands, as simple as that. There is some corruption also sometimes in land acquisitions by some people acquiring lands before a project takes place and then expropriation being in favor of those some authorities who have bought or taken the lands of people for nothing and then getting the indemnities. There are so many examples, access to justice, I would say independent justice. I mean, we can see that unfortunately, when there is no independent justice because of corruption, the violation of some basic human rights to have a normal decisions by justice is completely violated. In mineral rights sometimes as well, or for obtaining mining conventions. I mean, all this has for consequences that if there is a corruption, that would be less money, maybe, for example, for the population, for the health, for education, for all what they are entitled to. Therefore, we can see that indeed corruption is a nightmare for the respect of human rights. Therefore, indeed, it is clear that there are some links, and the EU regulation made that link, because in the EU regulation, you have now concerning due diligence on human rights, and it concerns also environment and governance and corruption.
The mining industry must take meaningful steps to address sustainability, as referenced by Anglo American. A healthy environment and thriving community have to be genuine priorities for business. Poverty is the biggest obstacle in the realisation of human rights, but businesses can bring many benefits and opportunities, providing they develop solid policies that ensure respect for human rights and provide remedies where they are violated. Lawyers must continue to be proactive, anticipating risks and playing a meaningful role in advising clients in this evolving area.